This is Holidays Unbound, Episode 3. Did the Exodus really happen? So, Ruth, welcome back for another episode. It's great to be together.
Great to be here, Dan.
All right, so today we're taking on this big question of the historicity of the Exodus. And, you know, when this is a holiday that basically is built around the Exodus story, at least it seems that it's worthy of a conversation to ask the basic question, is this story true? Did this actually happen?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question. I think Judaism makes a claim that this happened, and it's really important to the Jewish people. So I think we need to look at whether it really happened whatsoever. I know that when my kids were little, they used to ask me all the time, did Abraham really live? Did these things really happen? And we used to spend a lot of time discussing these things. And when we couldn't answer absolutely, then we had to start discussing the big ideas of, well, what's the meaning? So this, I think it's a question that some people like to avoid, honestly, because I don't think they want to know what the answer is.
Yeah, I mean, there was a famous story a few years ago that I remember reading about where Rabbi David Wolpe, who is a rabbi of a large conservative congregation in Los Angeles, I think at a Seder, at a synagogue Seder, he somehow indicated that he thought that the Exodus didn't really happen, or it wasn't historical, or at least wasn't historical in the way that it's described in the Bible. And it created a huge uproar. Like, people were very upset that he said it. And I don't know, this might be apocryphal, but I remember hearing somewhere that some people said, well, look, I mean, it's one thing for him to say it, but why did he have to say it at the Seder?
Well, or, you know, you can believe it, but you don't say it out loud. Well, see, and that's one of the things I like about this conversation and our approach to taking these things on is, let's look at those sacred cows. Let's talk about them and let's see if we can understand the reality and then figure out what we do when we raise these questions. If nothing else, it would make a great conversation to have at your Seder to talk about what you think the value of this story is, and if does it entirely rest on whether this was a historical event or not, because I think that's a big question.
Yeah, I agree.
We didn't feel qualified to answer these questions on our own and to really get into the nitty-gritty of whether the Exodus happened. So we turned to Professor Stephen Weitzman, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yep, so we began our conversation with Stephen Weitzman, asking him to help us situate the time of the Exodus in history, if it was historical. When do people think the Exodus happened, if they think of it as a historical event?
The Bible itself doesn't tell us that when things happened. It doesn't tell us that such and such an event happened in 1207 BC, for example. Scholars and movie makers, for that matter, like to put the Exodus story in the time of Ramses II. If you've ever seen The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, the Pharaoh there is identified as Ramses II. And that's based almost completely on the fact that the name Ramses appears as a name of one of two slave cities. But there's nothing that says this happened in a specific year.
According to Jewish tradition, the Jews were in Egypt for several hundred years. They built the pyramids. They were enslaved. Is there any evidence for that?
From a perspective of a modern secular scholar, it's very difficult to prove that something didn't happen. But in the case of the Exodus story, there are reasons to be doubtful. If you mean by evidence outside the Bible, there's absolutely no corroborating evidence for the Exodus. If the Exodus story had happened, and the Israelites were people who migrated or invaded the land of Canaan, come from somewhere else like Egypt, you would expect them to, like immigrants today, to bring some of their culture with them, different styles of pottery, different ways of building houses, something to tell us that they originated from some other place. But when archaeologists uncover the remains of early Israelite settlements, what they find is a culture, a material culture that is indigenous to the land of Canaan. And that has led scholars to conclude that the Israelites seem to have evolved out of the local population of Canaan and did not come in as migrants or conquerors or invaders.
So let's look at it from the other side, because I guess I could imagine a situation where the majority of the Israelites were not slaves in Egypt that came to the land of Canaan, but there may have been some small group that were slaves in Egypt and that came to the land of Canaan and merged with this larger group, and their story became the story of all of us. And I'm wondering, is there any type of evidence on the Egyptian side of things that there were slaves in Egypt, that there were Israelites that were there in some capacity, a la the Joseph story, or any of the other pieces of the story in terms of Egyptian history?
There is some evidence to support the idea that there's some kind of historical kernel behind the narrative that we have today in the Bible. So we do know, for example, that there were slaves who fled slavery in Egypt. We know that people went back and forth across the Sinai wilderness. We know specific groups of people, kind of nomads, who would kind of travel back and forth between Canaan and Egypt. So there's nothing inherently implausible about the idea of a small group of fugitives fleeing Egyptian slavery and migrating to the land of Canaan. We have no Egyptian sources that tell us about the Exodus in particular, or that mention the Hebrews. We do, however, have one Egyptian text that refers to Israel. It's a text called the Merneptah Stela. Merneptah was the name of a pharaoh, an Egyptian king. He was the son of Ramses II. And he left behind an inscription that's been dated to around 1207 BCE. It's a kind of celebration of various battles that this king had won in the land of Canaan. And among the various peoples that he conquers there, he says that he's conquered a people called Israel. But whoever they are, he doesn't describe them as former fugitives or ex-slaves. So we do have an Egyptian reference to Israel from 1207 BCE, but it doesn't refer at all to the Exodus story or corroborate what we have in the book of Exodus in particular.
But on that basis, when you talk about the Merneptah Stele, you would have imagined that if the Exodus had happened under the kingship of Ramses II, that if his son had then gone in and destroyed this people, Israel, it would have been a good chance that it would have mentioned that these were the people that had recently fled from Egypt.
If the Exodus happened, and if it happened in the way that the Bible describes, with 10 plagues and with the Egyptian army being decimated in the Red Sea, with the firstborn of Egypt being slain by the angel of death, if all that had happened, you would expect there to be some impression of that left behind in Egyptian sources. There isn't. And that's curious.
Is there anything in the Egyptian sources that would give rise to the biblical story that we have? Is there any way to connect that the Egyptian story with the biblical story?
There's one way, because there is another event that reminds us of the Exodus story a little bit. And that event is the invasion of Egypt by a group of people called the Hyksos. The Hyksos, that is actually an Egyptian word, and it means foreign rulers. And it refers to some kind of foreign group that came into Egypt probably in the 17th century BCE, so several hundred years before Merneptah. And they probably came from the region of Canaan or Syria, somewhere from around that area. They came in and they established a dynasty in Egypt, known as the Hyksos dynasty. And they ruled for about 200 years. And then there was a rebellion by the native population of Egypt against these foreign rulers, and they drove them out. And that expulsion of the Hyksos, the driving out of the Hyksos, has reminded scholars of the Exodus.
So how do we get from the Hyksos story, do you think, to the biblical story? Can you help us understand how that connection gets made?
One theory is that the Hyksos were expelled from Egypt by an Egyptian king, and this is in the 16th century, and they go back to where they came from. They go back to Canaan, Syria. This is a much, much larger group than the Israelites would have been. But they go back there, and their memories are passed on to their descendants. And so the kind of memory of what happened, the Egyptian expulsion, survived in the land of Canaan. Now, by the way, the other part of the story about how the Hyksos come to power, that has reminded scholars of the story of Joseph. Because you may remember from the book of Genesis that Joseph comes down into Egypt from Canaan. Eventually, his brothers and his father join him there. And Joseph rises to a position of authority within the Egyptian government. He becomes a kind of prime minister of Egypt. So some scholars believe that the Hyksos invasion is reflected in the story of Joseph's rise, and the expulsion of the Hyksos is the core of the Exodus story, a memory that was passed down from the Hyksos to all the descendants of Canaan. And what we have in the Exodus story is kind of the Israelite version of that memory.
So I've read about two other characters that I'm wondering if it's true that they might have some element of the Exodus story. One is an Egyptian king named Akhenaten, and the other is a group named the Abiru. Are you able to tell us anything about that?
Akhenaten was a very unusual ruler of Egypt. King Tut was actually his son. He had a wife named Nefertiti. He introduced a religious reform when he came to power. And basically, he's understood to be the first monotheist. He rejected the traditional religion of the Egyptians, which was polytheistic, and tried to replace it with a monotheistic cult of the sun god Aten. And because he was king, he was able to impose this religious reform on his subjects. And after he died, there was a kind of rebellion against that, and the Egyptians restored the traditional religion of the Egyptians. And some scholars think that he spread the idea, or somehow the idea of monotheism spread from him to the Israelites. The most famous person who argued that was Sigmund Freud, who in his work Moses and Monotheism argued that Moses was actually an Egyptian himself, a native Egyptian, a follower of Akhenaten. And in the time of the revolt against Akhenaten's cult, he fled Egypt along with some followers, and they became the Hebrews. The Habiru, that's actually from the same period of time. They're not an ethnic group. They're not a clan or a tribe. It's more like a social class of outsiders, people who lived on the margins of society in the ancient Near East. Sometimes they are outlaws, sometimes they're fugitives, sometimes they're troublemakers that appear in something like 200 sources that we have from the ancient Near East. But the most fascinating references to them are in a series of letters that were sent by the kings of Canaan in the time of Akhenaten. As I said, Canaan was a colony of Egypt, and there was a lot of correspondence between these local rulers and the Egyptian king. And a lot of these letters that we have, they're called the Amarna letters because they were found in Amarna. They are complaints that these kings have about the Habiru. Especially the king in Jerusalem complains about being harassed and attacked by this group of people called the Habiru. But obviously there's an interesting similarity between the word Habiru and the word Hebrew. And so a lot of scholars have come to the conclusion that the Habiru might be the predecessors to the Hebrews. That the Hebrews did not originate as a tribe or a clan or a family. They were part of this class of outsiders, of troublemakers, and that over time they developed a society of their own, they developed a kingdom of their own, and eventually become what we call the Hebrews or the Israelites. So that would explain why the Israelites seem to come out of indigenous Canaanite society. They might be an outgrowth of the underclass of Canaan in the time of Amarna.
Well, it sounds almost like it's possible that the biblical story creates a drama, but out of a reality that was not nearly as dramatic, by, you know, making it more interesting and more engaging and taking the ideas and making them their own and unique to the Israelites.
Exactly. So to a lot of scholars, it's very, very possible that the Exodus story preserves memories of real experiences, maybe the Hyksos expulsion, maybe some memory of Akhenaten, maybe other historical experiences that we don't know about, but it is woven these experiences together into a new narrative. And it's a narrative that is, first of all, it's a fantastic story, but also it's a very meaningful story. It's really a kind of foundation story for the Israelites themselves and the kind of society that they wanted to live in. So somebody at a later period of time took these historical memories and wove them into a kind of constitution of the Israelites, a story that kind of laid the foundations of the kind of society that the Israelites were trying to live with it.
Transitioning from the history to meaning, we talked to Professor Weitzman about whether the story still has power and what its power might be. Does it still merit having a holiday built around it if the story didn't happen the way the Bible tells it, or the way that the Jewish imagination has had it for so long?
I find the Exodus story to be the most powerful story ever told. It's obviously important to Jews, but it's been incredibly important to other peoples as well. And the Exodus as an historical event, we have questions about it. It's not clear that it happened. But the Exodus as a story, as a narrative, that's an historical reality. That story's been around for more than 2,000 years. And that story, whatever happened behind that story, I would argue it doesn't make much of a difference. The story itself unleashed certain aspects of human imagination and allowed people to reconceive their relationship to the world around them. Up until that time, all the stories that we have up until that time are usually from the point of view of the powerful. They're stories that were told by kings or on behalf of kings. They're stories about the elite, the 1%. If you think about Homer, those are all stories about the aristocracy of that society. The Exodus story is really the first story that is from the point of view of the oppressed, from people who are victims of power. And the very telling of that story changed reality, and it really allowed, for the first time, it allowed a people to imagine that God was on their side as opposed to being on the side of the kings. And that is just an incredible historical event in its own right. So while I've been very skeptical of the Exodus as an historical event, that's a very different issue than the Exodus as a story, which I would argue is one of the most consequential events in the history of human imagination.
That's a great way to think about it. I think that I could imagine people coming together around a Passover table to talk about the stories of the less powerful standing up to power, and that becoming, and all of us have stories of that sort, and it's not so much about the historical reality, and it's more about that critical theme that runs through the holiday and through this narrative and has given hope to oppressed people, as you said, Jews, African Americans, and others, as a more universal truth, that that's a possibility. And even in dark times or in difficult moments, we can have hope because it has happened before, and that's a story that's a possible story to tell. The one concern I have about this story, though, and it's something that I've heard and I think plays into contemporary context, is that the Egyptians then get a bad rap that they don't deserve. What do we do with that?
That is a very problematic part of the story, as is the fact that the Exodus leads to the Israelites conquering the land of Canaan and killing or driving off the native population of Canaan. That's also a very disturbing part of the story because of the role that violence plays in the establishment of Israelite society. But remember, a very, very important part of the Exodus story is that we are enjoined to treat strangers in a certain way in light of the experience of being oppressed ourselves. And so the story has a problematic side, but it's also urging us to exercise empathy, to put ourselves in the shoes of those who are currently oppressed.
So we asked Professor Weitzman to reflect on the question that, well, if the story isn't historical, then that probably gives us more permission than we may have thought to make some tweaks to the story, to fix things up that we don't particularly like or that don't resonate with us anymore today. But on the flip side, if the story isn't true with a capital T, then why should we take it seriously at all?
We are always responsible for the stories that we tell. There's no law that says we have to tell a story over and over and over again. If we're telling that story, it's because we want to tell that story, because that story serves some purpose for us. So we're responsible for the stories we tell. We're morally responsible for the stories that we tell. And if the stories that we're telling lead to injustice or if they lead to harm to people, we're responsible for that. And if the story does good in the world, that's something to take pride in. And moments like Passover are an opportunity for people to wrestle with those issues together.
I love that. I love that line. If I'm going to take anything away, in addition to all the history I've learned, the thing that I'm going to be thinking about is we're responsible for the stories that we tell. And I think that that's a great lesson for the Passover story itself and for the responsibility to tell stories at Passover, that we should all be thinking actively about that responsibility, because no matter what story we tell or we don't tell, it has a consequence.
Not too long ago, Professor Weitzman was asked to write an article, a kind of counterfactual article, although I guess we could also call it a potentially factual article, that reflects on what would be the significance if the Exodus never happened.
In that article I develop, I really focus on the story of the Exodus and what would have happened to the Jews if there hadn't been a story of the Exodus. I don't think there would be Jews without that story. I think we as a people need that story. And you could delete almost any other story from the Bible, and I think probably there would still be Jews, with maybe one or two exceptions. But the Exodus story is just inextricable from the Jewish people. And if you take away the story, there's no more Jewish people.
Do you say that because it's the Exodus story that sort of forms the Jewish people, or do you say that because it's the Exodus story that has given the Jewish people some sense of meaning and purpose, which has given it its drive to survive?
But one of the lessons of the Exodus story is that God takes his time, that God doesn't intervene right away. The Israelites are slaves for 400 years before they are rescued. They, you know, when they go to Egypt in the time of Jacob and Joseph, they go with a promise. They've been promised by God that their descendants will inherit the land of Canaan. And they're promised that the descendants of Abraham will make a great nation. And exactly the reverse happens to them when they go into Egypt. They lose the land of Canaan, and this Egyptian king tries to exterminate them. So it seems as if God's promise has been broken, and they are in that state for 400 years. And it's only after 400 years that God then sends Moses to rescue them. So one of the, you know, very basic lessons of the Exodus story is that if you're going to have a relationship with God, you have to be patient. And God isn't going to act immediately or directly or in an obvious way. He's going to work out his plans over a very gradual and long period of time. So I you know, my understanding of Jewish history is that that belief was crucial for Jews in times when they were being persecuted, in times when their lives were very bleak. How did they keep hope? And part of what sustained hope for them was that they had this memory, this collective memory, the story of the Exodus that reminded them that even though things may seem terrible now and there may seem no hope now, that God will eventually redeem them. So that's just an example of many, many lessons that there are in the Exodus story that I think were kind of crucial for the survival of the Jews and the survival of hope for the Jews.
So I'm curious how you think the two parts of what we've discussed jibe together, in the sense that if the power of this story is that it's one that has given hope to Jews and others over such a long period of time because they internalized ideas that God takes a long time and we should wait patiently, or various other kinds of sources of spiritual sustenance, what do we do at the point that we now have doubts about the veracity of this story, about whether God actually intervened at all, whether God even exists? How do we take a story like this seriously, and how do we still get that kind of sustenance from it?
What you're speaking to is part of the reason why a lot of scholars, why a lot of people do not like scholarship. Because scholarship complicates and undoes a lot of what they believe about the world, and it makes the universe seem more confusing and disappointing, frankly. And, you know, we have in America many people who reject theory of evolution and prefer the Genesis account of creation, and that's partly because they really don't like the implications of the theory of evolution and what, at least from their perspective, it does to their sense of purpose and meaning of life. So there's a lot, there's a kind of allergy that a lot of people have to critical scholarship, a kind of resistance to it. And it's understandable because it does undercut the universe as a meaningful, purposeful place where things make sense. But on the other hand, what is in the end the Exodus story about? And it's about how people became free. And for me, freedom is meaningless unless it involves intellectual freedom, the freedom of thought, a freedom to question. And one of the, you know, aspects of the Passover Seder that I love about it is the fact that it has at its core questioning, asking questions. So I think that that freedom, ironically, requires the ability to question, requires the ability to doubt, and that if we are able to doubt, and if we're able to ask questions, and if we're able to challenge what people have always believed about the Exodus story or about God, on the one hand, that's disturbing, but on the other hand, that's proof that we're free, and that's proof that the Exodus worked. That's really how I try to bring together what I understand to be the lessons of the Exodus story with my commitment to modern scholarship.
So, Ruth, where does our conversation with Steve Weitzman leave your thoughts?
I think that there's something powerful that of all the ways to tell this story, we chose this one, this idea of the oppressed coming out victorious. And instead of giving ourselves, we are the descendants from God and it was always good and it was always right, we put some humility into our foundation narrative. I think that's critical. I think that that's critical no matter what approach we take to the historicity. And I think that while the wonders and signs might be a little bit over the top, especially for our modern sensibility and understanding of the way things work. I think the idea that there's something wonderful about the idea that you could hope for something impossible to actually happen. And I think that for me, spiritually, that resonates very, very profoundly. I think when we get stuck in places that are really narrow and hard, then having that. So I think that some of the fundamental messages don't get changed just because the story may or may not have happened as described in the Bible.
A few years ago, I was struggling with Passover, with the Seder in different ways. And I had actually recently been teaching at a Catholic law school. And so I was really focused on this idea of the Eucharist and this idea, right, that there's a sacred transformation of this food going on. And then we eat it, not we, but Catholics eat it, and that it somehow affects them in some deep way, either a spiritual way or a physical way or both, you know, and it really kind of focused me on this idea of you are what you eat, you know, and I tried to take that seriously with the Seder. And I remember thinking about the foods that we eat before the meal, the symbolic foods, right, the bitter herb and the charoset and the matzah and everything, that rather than thinking of them as symbols, what if we actually thought of them as kind of a ritualized you are what you eat, meaning that the story becomes true when we tell it as if it were true, and when we kind of do these acts like eating food that symbolizes the story, and we take it into our bodies, and in a sense, we're actually being transformed at that moment, right, in our own minds, of course, such that it doesn't actually matter whether the story happened in history, but actually we're deciding to live our lives as if it happened in whatever plane is meaningful to us, you know, that makes a difference. And at that point, it feels to me like it doesn't matter whether it's historically true or not, because we live in a community that's decided to build itself around the story that this happened, not as a historical claim necessarily, but as a, I don't know what we would really call it, as a sort of origin story that, like, we want to be our origin story, right? Because we think that it makes us better in the world if we see ourselves as a people who used to be slaves, right? Like, if we believe that we were a people who used to be slaves, then we will understand that when we see others who are enslaved around us or others who are in impoverished conditions around us, that we have a responsibility even more so to help them, not only because everybody has that responsibility, but because we still remember when we were in that position. Now, if it turns out that we actually never were in that position, does it really matter? You know, if it's a good thing, if it helps you be a better person in the world to believe something like that, and you actually have this annual ritualized experience in which in some certain fashion you kind of take that story on yourself, you know, it's almost like a form of conversion. Let's say it this way, right? Anybody who is converting to Judaism or who has converted to Judaism, right? It's not actually the case that their own ancestors, biologically, were slaves in Egypt. That is simply not true, and they don't ever claim that it's true. But they have decided to join this people for whom it may or may not be true. And what's interesting to think about is that what if essentially every single Jew is a convert in that way, right? Because it really doesn't matter whether it happened at all. If it happened, it probably happened to a very small number of people. But essentially, in the same way that we accept and are thrilled to have converts to Judaism, so what if we're all converts? We all decided that this is a story that we're taking on upon ourselves, whether it really actually happened physically at all or to our ancestors. So to me, like, something like that is where I really ultimately have found a connection to the Seder and to the story.
And I'm really curious to hear about how other people make the story their own, because the reality is, I don't think most of us are thinking about whether it really happened or not most of the time. I don't think we're sitting there with our Haggadot and maps of Egypt and trying to plot out the route of, you know, Google Maps. How do I get from Pharaoh's palace to the temple and in Jerusalem? We don't do that, right? So that's not really the focus of the holiday. Not that it's the wrong question to ask. It's a great question to ask, and I'm really glad we did. But I think it forces us to then push us to think more about this important symbolic and other ways in which this story has meaning, that we shouldn't just fall back on that. We should understand it and then move forward with that renewed understanding. It's asking the question gives us an opportunity to dig deeper and get better.
Yeah, and it actually makes me think about the experience that I had. I've spoken about it a little bit on Judaism Unbound. When I was 17 and I read Richard Elliot Friedman's book, Who Wrote the Bible, for the first time. And I think that a lot of people, when they're exposed to biblical criticism for the first time, the scholarly ideas that the Bible has multiple authors, etc., that it raises questions in their minds about whether God had any role in this, and perhaps God didn't have any role in this, and whether or not that's what the scholars themselves are putting out there. It's not what Richard Friedman says, but nevertheless, people have these questions, and they ask whether everything I've learned up till now has been wrong, has been BS. It's all a house of cards, and so what's the point? When I read it, I had a very different experience, which, you know, I'm not sure that I could have exactly described it this way when I was 17, but I had a version of it which was saying, wow, it is so cool to discover that there was this actual history, right? And what happened in actual history was that the story was constructed, right? And it's really fascinating to me, right? That's for sure, right? So it's very fascinating to me to ask the question, why was the story constructed? And if it turns out that the story was constructed because there were people who just wanted to tell a big lie, right? And they were just, you know, it was the opiate of the masses or whatever. Well, that's kind of a depressing and not very exciting endpoint. But if the reason why these stories were constructed was because there were people who were trying to join one another, right? Trying to combine as a single people and trying to retell their joint stories in a way that harmonized them. And, you know, and if they discovered that they had all had different experiences in Egypt at different points and they put them all together into a story with a little bit of extra magic in it that made it seem like it was this deep origin story that allowed us to be a single family, that's pretty exciting as history. And if the Passover Seder becomes this annual reenactment of that decision to be together as a people and to try to tell a story that gives meaning to our peopleness, that to me starts to get at the possibility of Passover and of the Seder as being something truly significant and truly wonderful in terms of our own modern experience, that we don't have to get hung up on this question of, like, do we really believe that all these miracles or all these terrible things happened to the Egyptians, etc., you know, but really what we should be focused on is the, which I think actually is what most people actually are focused on subconsciously, at least, is that we have done this every year, right? We've done this Seder thing for so long, right? This has become the connective tissue for the Jews for so long. And there's something, I think, really significant and really historical in that.
We have an opportunity with this story to think about what it symbolized then when it was created and written. But because we're supposed to think about that we ourselves are as though we ourselves went out from Egypt, we have an opportunity to think about what it means for us right now. What does it mean for us to tell a story this way? And I think we have every good reason to go on and have a Seder this year and to grapple with it and maybe even take on this question and really, you know, challenge us to think about the ways in which, and I think given our political climate, who writes the stories? What stories do we write? And how does that connect to the reality, and how do those things interplay? That would be a great conversation.
Yeah, we do hope that you'll incorporate these questions into your Seder, the questions of the historicity of the Exodus. What parts of the story are historical? What parts are not historical? What do you think? And whether you think it matters and why? Please report back to us. We're excited about incorporating your ideas onto our website and in future conversations on this podcast when we get to Passover next time. And we're really interested to know what people think. So not to throw a complete monkey wrench into the works here, but I want to share a conversation that I had with Professor Richard Elliot Friedman, the author of Who Wrote the Bible. He's a professor at the University of Georgia, and we interviewed him on Judaism Unbound in episode 27 about basic ideas of biblical criticism. But he's currently working on a project called The Exodus. It's a book that's going to be published in September, and we're excited to be able to interview him on Judaism Unbound around the time of publication. But he was kind enough to share some of his ideas with us now, right before Passover, and it's a fascinating exploration that he's done into the story of the Exodus, and his conclusion is that it is a historical event, and he can pinpoint who it happened to and why he thinks it matters. So we're really thrilled to be able to share some of his thinking with you. And we're really curious about how this part of the conversation connects in your mind with the conversation that we had with Steve Weitzman. So here's my conversation with Professor Richard Elliott Friedman about his research on this topic, which, as I said, will soon be published in a book appropriately entitled The Exodus.
I was drawn into this Exodus question. I didn't set out to be on it, but, you know, when duty calls, when so many of my colleagues are out there saying nothing happened, I'm bothered by that because that's simply not correct in light of the evidence. And our field is supposed to go by evidence. There are those who say nothing happened, period. No Exodus, no Moses, no nothing. And then there are others who say, well, it may have happened, but not the way it's told in the Bible. And I go, oh, my God, not the way it's told in the Bible? Really? You mean the Red Sea didn't actually split? Do you mean when you say it happened, but not the way it's told in the Bible? You mean sticks didn't turn into taninim, dragons? The sun didn't go out for 3 days. We never thought that anyway. I mean, I understand if an Orthodox Jew or an evangelical Christian believes all that literally, but biblical scholars and archaeologists in general didn't necessarily, you know, they're not literalists. They don't think the world began with two naked people, a magic tree, and a talking snake. So when an archaeologist says, well, maybe it happened, but not the way it's told in the Bible, we say, well, what on earth are you talking about then? And when you ask, well, what is this evidence against there having been an Exodus? It's almost all about quantities. They say, we've combed the Sinai. You always hear that expression. We've combed the Sinai, and we've been doing it for a long time. And if there had been a couple million people there for 40 years, we should have found something. And then people who disagree with them always quote that line, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. Other things that have to do with quantities are they say, well, look, if you look in the earliest culture of Israel, in our first couple centuries that we can get at in archaeology, like 12th, 11th century BCE, we don't find any reference in Egypt to any of their slaves being called Israelites or Jews or whatever. And every word of that is true. But all of that, at most, would be an indication against a big exodus. That's only questioning the numbers in the Bible. It's true. If there were 603,550 adult males, as the text says, plus all the women and all the kids, so you're looking at 2.5 million people, you'd expect there'd be something. I don't know exactly what it is they think they would have found. They say we've combed the Sinai. That's simply not true. Nobody has combed the Sinai. There was a survey of Sinai. We haven't excavated the whole Sinai. And what would they find anyway? A piece of petrified wood signed by Aaron, and it said, Moses, Mom always liked you better. And we know it's true because it says 3200 BC on it. Secondly, I would admit that maybe it's true that if there are a couple million people for 40 years, yeah, maybe we'd find something. But still, that's only questioning whether it was a big exodus. Would it ruin your day if the exodus is historical, but the number was added later and is an exaggeration? And so scholars, which include myself, have looked at rather the question that there were, in fact, people from Western Asia, call them Semites, people from the region that today is Israel and its neighbors, in Egypt. And they were coming and going for something like 400 years, which as it happens is the amount of time that the Bible says. They just weren't coming and going in giant numbers at a time. There were many small exodi all the time. And in my work, I've tried to identify one of them, and it makes sense to me that it was the Levites,
because it's been around.
That is why now in the Hebrew Bible, the public debate,
there are eight people
on that from Israel who have Egyptian names.
And it makes sense to me that it was the Levites.
Moshe, Phinehas, Hur, Moses. And all eight of those people in the Bible are Levites. So the only people with Egyptian names that we know are Levites, and everybody else in Israel that we have does not have an Egyptian name. And when the Song of the Sea, that's the oldest thing in the Bible, close to whatever happened in time, never once mentions the word Israel and never suggests that the Am who came out of Egypt went to all of Israel, that's suggestive. And if at around the same period, the second oldest thing in the Bible, the Song of Deborah, has Deborah summon the 10 tribes of northern Israel for the battle in which Israel first achieved hegemony over the Canaanites. And when she summons the 10 tribes, it doesn't include the Levites, either because they're the priests, not a tribe, or because they weren't there yet. They're still in Egypt or on the road. And other evidence from the oldest songs, and the five oldest things in the Bible, which all happen to be songs. These things lead us, along with an array of other evidence, to understand that the likelihood that it was the Levites who experienced the Exodus. Now, Levite wasn't a name in biblical times. The word Levi, you know, in Hebrew, it's a root meaning of someone who's attached to or joined to a group. It would perfectly describe these Western Asiatic people. When they were in Egypt, they were aliens, they were outsiders who became attached to Egyptian society, or it could describe them, these Levite people, when they arrived in Israel, where they became adjoined to the other Israelites, and then later adopted, so to speak, and identified as a tribe. But originally, they're not a tribe, they're a group of people. And so it's not a big surprise that you don't find any Egyptian records referring to Israelite slaves there, because they weren't yet called Israelites. And it wouldn't refer to Levite slaves there, because Levite isn't their name as a people, it's just what they are in their own language. So when people say, well, we can't find references to them in Egyptian texts, I don't know what you'd look for in an Egyptian text. It's not going to say Jew, it's not going to say Israelite. Now, but I've just given you as a really short version or one or two items of evidence. Nobody should be persuaded just by this little bit that we're able to cover at this time. That's why you write books. So when my book comes out in September, there are 10 categories of evidence that are at the very least, if not fact, it's the most likely scenario that some group of what became Israel, the group that is we call the Levites, really experienced the Exodus from Egypt. Then they show up in Israel and become Israel's priest. And they, as the priestly class, these Levites teach everybody words that we retain to this day in the Haggadah as well as in the Torah. When your child asks you, why do we do this? You're supposed to answer, because we were slaves to Pharaoh, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt to give us this land. It's all taught as the experience of all of Israel. And in the field where you can find almost any Bible scholar making the analogy to Thanksgiving in the United States, that how many people do you know are descended from the Pilgrims or from the Wampanoag Native Americans, and yet here we are, we're all going out and buying turkeys and singing about it and celebrating Thanksgiving.
So how do you think about the implications of your discoveries and your idea that the Exodus was a historical event that was experienced by this group, the Levites? How do you think that that should affect the way we think about it today?
When a whole nation of people sign on to a story, and they retain it for 3,000 years, as we have, then if you find out that it started with one kernel of us and not with every single one of us, I don't see why that ruins it at all. Any club, any fraternity, any religion, any country, it always starts with some group, with some core. But then everybody who joins and signs on, it becomes theirs too. I mean, Thanksgiving really is mine, too, and I know I am not descended from a Puritan or a Wampanoag, but it's my holiday, and that doesn't bother me. And Pesach is my holiday, even if I know that since I'm not a Levite, I may not be descended directly from one of the people who actually set foot out of Egypt and arrived in Israel. Those people had the experience of being Leviim, attached people, outsiders, aliens, gerim, for some long period of time. And when they got to Israel and became the teachers and priests of Israel, they taught everybody, don't treat us the way we were treated in Egypt. Don't treat anybody the way we were treated in Egypt. We're going to be different. You can't oppress an alien. The first occurrence of the word Torah in the Torah is in Exodus 12, where it says, you shall have one Torah for the citizen and for the alien. And the commands in the laws of the Torah to treat an alien the same as a citizen occur 52 times. How many things can you name that occur 52 times in the Torah? And in the documentary hypothesis, three of the four main sources of the Torah, the ones called E, P, and D, are traced to Levites, Levite priests, and the other source, J, is not. All 52 occur in the Levite sources and zero in the non-Levite source. And they don't just say you have to treat aliens the same as citizens. They tell you why. It says it six times. Because you were aliens in the land of Egypt. And even everybody knows the line, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Some people say that means only love your fellow Jew as yourself. They are wrong. That's just wrong. The word there, love your re'ah as yourself, absolutely means any human being. But even if it didn't, in the same passage, it's Leviticus 19, my favorite chapter of the Torah, in that same place, and you know, a couple of places in the Torah, it says, you will v'ahavta et gercha, you will love your alien, and you will love him as yourself. This is an extraordinary message to the world. And in ancient Near Eastern law, there were other law codes that cared about the poor and the oppressed. There are ancient law codes that care about the widow and the orphan and the lowly and the poor. But to my knowledge, there is no ancient Near Eastern law code that applies that also to foreigners. But in ancient Israel, a Greek on vacation in Israel, a Babylonian on vacation in Israel, who goes to court has the same protections that I do. And that's a game changer for civilization. So if this is correct, that the Leviim were these Asians in Africa experiencing being an alien and who came back and made it part of the essence of Judaism and reminded us of it 52 times in the Torah, that we have to love everyone as ourselves and not mistreat foreigners when they're in our power, that's tremendous. So the Exodus, it's not just that it happened, and it's not whether it happened exactly the way the Bible tells it or not. It's that it's happened and it made literally all the difference in the world.
Well, I can't think of a better note to end this episode on. And so again, we really do want to hear from you how you've incorporated these ideas into your experience of Passover this year, what you want to know more about, what you're thinking about. And we'll just conclude by reminding you that this is an experimental 5-episode edition of Holidays Unbound. We're really excited about launching this podcast in a big way in the fall. In order to do that, we need to hire an editor who can really help us create these intricate episodes that we want to do with interspersed conversations like you heard today, but even more so. If you are interested in helping us do that, you can make a donation at www.judaismunbound.com/donate. And if you're interested in making a larger donation to really help us move this forward in a big way, you can do it through the website, but you can also send me an email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org, and we can have a longer conversation about it. We'd also love to get your feedback on this podcast, and you can send me an email at that same address, dan@nextjewishfuture.org, with any comments and suggestions about the podcast. Coming up in the next couple of episodes, we have an episode about the Seder, and we also have an episode coming up about the food for Passover, which we're really excited about. So thank you so much for being with us, and Ruth, it's been great to be with you. We'll see you in the next episode.
See you then.
Great. And with that, this has been Holidays Unbound.